This is The Irrationally Exuberant. I'm Reed Messerschmidt.
It's Valentine's Day, 2015, and my wife and I are at an event called the Sweetheart Ball. We're quite fancy. It's a fundraiser for the Ronald McDonald House, a very worthy not-for-profit organization that provides free room and board for folks whose children are in the hospital. It receives some of its funding from the fast food chain, McDonald's. So, of course, the titular Ronald McDonald is in attendance. A Ronald McDonald. At any given time, there are hundreds of adult human beings wandering the streets that are authorized to don the iconic red and yellow suit, fright wig, and grease paint. This particular Ronald McDonald it might be time for him to hang up the old clown shoes. His face is looking a bit craggy, a lot craggy, and he's not really acting like a clown. He's kind of just acting like an irritating regular person. Someone who came to the party on their own and doesn't really know anyone, but is determined to make friends. He's aimlessly walking around, interrupting conversations, and telling bad jokes to blank stares. And when he's between people, he looks very sad, very adrift. His real lips are pursed tight within his painted-on grin. This is not a room full of children, after all. This is a room full of, to a large extent, moneyed middle-aged couples in suits and dresses. I can only assume that he is wondering to himself what exactly he is doing here. Maybe he's thinking about life after Ronald. Will his grown children maybe consider speaking to him again once he no longer dresses in this preposterous costume? Probably not. Who could ever love a Ronald McDonald, even a former Ronald McDonald? A fucking hamburger clown. A corporate shill. They'd smell it on him. How did I let this happen to me? Anyway, the ball progresses. There is a silent auction. Dinner is served. As we are eating, the program begins. Various thank yous and acknowledgments and heart-rending videos are proffered. A family comes onto the dais to tell their story, how the Ronald McDonald House helped them in their time of crisis. Their little boy, just a baby at the time, only months old, was in critical condition. They didn't have any money. They lived a long way from any hospital that could do him any good, and they would not leave his side. The RMH gave them a way to be near to him without spending money that they didn't have, provided them the comforts of home. The boy survived and is now a healthy, adorable 2-year-old. His name, like most kids these days, is Mason. He comes on stage, very shy, very sleepy. It's past his bedtime. There's not a dry eye in the house. And then, as this family, who has just relived the worst moments of their lives, is about to return to their seats, Ronald McDonald enters stage left. He waves off the parents. They are confused and do as he says. Now it's just Ronald and Mason. Mason begins to cry, so Ronald motions for the parents to come back to get him. He seems a bit irritated. They get the kid and return to their seats. Now it's just Ronald, and the room is dead quiet. He speaks into the microphone. I'd like to sing Mason a lullaby. First, I'll hum for 30 seconds to find the right pitch, and then I'll sing him a lullaby. A short time I have to be with you, my love. But a short time is better than no time, you see. So I'll give to you all my possessions. And would that you'd share them with me. I'll bring you one springtime of robins. One springtime of robins to sing. And I'll bring you one summer of roses. One summer of roses I'll bring. And I'll bring you the dry leaves of autumn. Dry leaves will be helpful, you know, to soften the fall of your snowflakes. What I bring you, your winter of snow. Thank you. And then he gets off the stage without another word. That is exactly how it happened, I swear it. The humming and everything. The crowd is stunned. What did we just see? Did that sad clown just sing a romantic love song by Willie Nelson to a 2-year-old boy? A cappella? It was like a scene from a David Lynch movie. And then slowly the clink of silverware on plates started up again and everyone moved on. It was amazing. And it got me to wondering, what the fuck is this guy? Not the craggy-faced man beneath the makeup. I get him, I think. I mean, what the fuck is Ronald McDonald? What is his function? I understand that he was created to sell hamburgers, but why is he still here? He wasn't selling any hamburgers at the Sweetheart Ball. Most of the people there wouldn't know an Egg McMuffin from the proverbial Zune. He seems like a relic of a different, maybe simpler, though probably not, and also equally shitty, if not more shitty, time. I thought back to all of the encounters I've had with this clown. When I was very young, he was ubiquitous, on TV constantly. I had birthday parties at McDonald's, but I don't think he was there. He came to my elementary school a few times to promote physical fitness, if you can believe that. His statue sits outside of the Ronald McDonald House, greeting the grieving. He's infiltrated my dreams. I don't know what these things have in common, and despite a lifetime with this guy on the periphery, at the very least, I couldn't give you one single defining characteristic of what makes Ronald Ronald that isn't aesthetic. He's a character without a defined perspective, a perpetually grinning American golem that has outgrown his initial purpose. He still exists in the world, but selling garbage food to unsuspecting dolts doesn't seem to be his modus operandi anymore. At least not the primary one. So, what is? 15 years ago, 96% of the children in the United States could identify Ronald McDonald more than any other character, fictional or otherwise, though this number is probably lower today. Why? Is it due just to sheer exposure or something more sinister? Primary school kids in Beijing reported that they like Uncle Ronald because he is funny, gentle, kind, and he understands the hearts of children. That sounds like a shitty translation job if you ask me, and besides, what does it even mean? These questions haunted me, so I did some research, like watched every Ronald McDonald's commercial ever, which brought me to McDonaldland, the entire Ronald McDonald universe, including all of his weird friends, which I knew existed but had never thought much about. These things complicated matters. It's all very strange. So I did some more research, and now I'm making this podcast. What I found is more shocking than I could have ever imagined. So, let's get to the bottom of this whole damn business. Turns out that to truly understand Ronald McDonald, you have to go back to the year of our Lord, 1308, in Scotland. A man named Robert the Bruce was king, and RTB had a very good friend, a druid from a long line of druids, beginning with the warlord Gillibride, a renowned eater of soul and liege to the Dark One himself, onto his son Somerled and his sons Ranald and Donald. Ranald and Donald. His name was Angus Og MacDonald. That's right, folks. Angus MacDonald. His first name was a type of beef, and his last name was MacDonald. His middle name was Og, as I said. A pretty solid middle name, if you ask me. Angus and Robert the Bruce were allies of, you guessed it, the Knights Templar, who were fleeing the wrath of Pope Clement V, who had caved to the King of France, of all people, and decided the god now hated the famed Holy Order just because they spit on the cross and worshiped the devil. The Templars sought refuge in the arms of the Scots, who, being pagans, were sympathetic to the satanic leanings of the Knights. Fast forward through 600 years of untold evil and carnage, and the MacDonald bloodline lives on to this very day, still loyal to the Knights Templar and their hideous, all-powerful progeny, the Illuminati. Not one of the infamous 13 Illuminati bloodlines, but a constant companion of those families. So, you can see beyond a shadow of a doubt that McDonald's, the omnipresent fast food chain, is a front for the Illuminati and a key player in their quest for a new world order. McDonald's has been given permission to and opened franchise locations in front of the Pantheon in Rome and behind Egypt's Luxor Temple. In both cases, the restaurant lines up perfectly with an Egyptian obelisk, even the one in Rome. Or how about this? If you spin a McDonald's sign 90 degrees, it looks like the number 13. 13, that's a very significant number to the Illuminati. It's the date the Knights Templar were purged. On that same McDonald's sign, take a look at where the golden arches, golden for sun god, it should be noted, fall on the word McDonald's. The leftmost touchpoint is over the M, the middlemost touchpoint is over the O and the N and kind of the A. The rightmost touchpoint is over the S. What does that spell? Monas. Flip a few letters around, Mason, as in Freemason, perhaps you've heard of them. And those three touchpoints? Pyramids. Look at it. For the first time in your pathetic life, really look at it. It's as plain as an inexplicably delicious vanilla McDonald's ice cream cone. And as if you needed any further proof, listen to this spine-tingling testimonial that I found on the internet. I quote, "On the afternoon of Tuesday, June 7th in 1977, aged and perhaps senile, McDonald's founder Ray Kroc appeared on the TV talk show Mike Douglas, and I just happened to be watching. I was only a teenager then, but the show was seared into my memory. When Mike Douglas asked Ray what he did with all his money, he replied that he belonged to a satanic church and donated a lot of his money to it. I told my family what I had seen, and we stopped eating at McDonald's for quite a while after that, as did many others." Unquote. This gentleman has been unable to find any proof of said Mike Douglas interview because the McDonald's Corporation doesn't want you, its blind, loyal patrons, nay, slaves, to see it. And there's more. You know Baphomet, the horrible, winged, goat-headed, human-bodied god of the Knights Templar? Switch some of the letters around, and do you know what you get? Meat fob, as in a piece of meat shaped like a key fob, a piece of maybe chicken? Oh, sure, fob spelt a little differently, but it's clearly referring to McNuggets. All right, I'm getting hotter than a Carolina Reaper on an Alabama August afternoon. Let's break for commercial, and when we come back, I'll reveal the sinister symbolism behind McDonaldland. Don't go turning that dial.
You've heard the ads for investing all of your earthly wealth in gold, as it is the only historically reliable tender, and everything else will be just so much nest-making debris once our civilization and infrastructure inevitably collapses. That's a necessity, and that's a fact. You've heard the ads for stockpiling non-perishable food in the form of military-grade MREs to prepare for the forthcoming apocalypse and sustain yourself while holed up where the rogue homosexuals can't get you. That's a necessity, and that's a fact. You've heard the ads for speculative apocalyptic fiction written by some of the finest, most open-eyed men and women of this or any generation, the only ones that know the truth about the gay bird revolution. That's not a necessity, maybe, but that's a damn fine thing to have, and that's a fact. But my question is this. How in the holy fuck do you expect to fit all this into your custom home bunker? What are you going to do when those sexual deviants and hollow-boned, feathery sons of bitches come knocking down your door and there's only room for three out of the four members of your family on account of the heaps of gold and powdered food and magazines and paperbacks? Are you just going to leave little Jimmy out there to fend for himself? The gays and the burrs will tear him apart from both ends, for Christ's sake. Have you thought that through, you ignorant sheep? I guess you haven't, but I have. I've run that scenario through my head more times than I care to think about. Hi, I'm Burlap Bundy, proud second cousin to the infamous patriotic Bundy family of government standoff fame, and I've got just the thing to save you from the aforementioned nightmare scenario. Burlap Bundy's solid gold survivalist storage chest is made of pure solid gold and can fit all of your MREs, in addition to being engraved with survivalist tips and speculative fiction. And best of all, it takes up a mere 77% of the space that those items would otherwise inhabit. And that's a necessity, and that's a fact. Now you listen, and you listen well. We all know that the gays and the birds and their gay bird hybrids have gained a stronghold in the modern world, thanks to the Illuminati's New World Order objectives and chemtrails. That's a fact. But I happen to be of the opinion that we don't have to just sit back and wait to be sodomized or carried off into the sky or pecked to death or all of the above or God knows what. We can, we must, defend ourselves and our American families so that we may live to fight another day. Those of you listening to me now may be heterosexual humanity's only hope. In order to do that, though, you need to be economical about how you use your bunker space, which makes Burlap Bundy's solid gold survivalist storage chest an absolute necessity. Now, let's not get hung up on the price here. It's a lot, I'm not going to lie to you. But how are you going to put a price on the safety of you and yours? You can't do it. And if you can, perhaps you are one of the bird people, or the gays, or the hybrids. In that case, get! We don't want you here. And let me tell you, I may be biased since I wrote it, but the speculative fiction engraved on these things is of the absolute highest caliber. And that's .905. Your family will delight you and learn from gripping tales of mass gay birdmen gang rapes, heroic heterosexual escapes, and erotic heterosexual encounters just for the ladies. Here's a little taste. Get your filthy feathers off of my woman, Burl cried in his manly baritone, shaking the gay birdmen to their very core and all the way down to their massive, feathery dongs. They turned to face him, forgetting all about pecking Sarah Palin to death with their razor-sharp, AIDS-infected beaks. It was clear what they had a mind to do by their throbbing bird dicks and the sparkle in their black eyes. Burl didn't much cotton to that notion, but he couldn't let them hurt Sarah. She was too voluptuous and important. So he did what he had to do, as he always did. The brave thing. Come and get it, you winged fags. He unclasped his massive gold snake's head belt buckle, unzipped his fly, wriggled out of his dusty old skin-tight dungarees, presented his meaty, muscle-rippled shanks to the hideous, lusty birdmen, and prepared for their massive, downy warmth to enter him. Wow, that's good stuff. So call 1-800-GOLD-BOX now to get your Burlap Bundy's solid gold survivalist storage chest. Stock is limited because it takes for fucking ever to engrave these goddamn things. Order within the next 30 minutes and get a free space pen. Do it immediately, goddammit. These gay birds could strike at any moment. Burlap Bundy's solid gold survivalist storage chest. They are a necessity, and that's a fact.
Welcome back. Now, please, if you'll humor me for a moment, close your eyes. Are you driving? This will only take a minute. You'll be fine. Imagine, if you will, McDonaldland, a vast world of unspeakable pleasures and horrors, existing in a hazy middle ground between cartoon and real life. God knows how big this world really is. No one, not even Ronald, has ever dared venture to its furthest edges. The portion you're in now is a relatively happy one. The portion around which everything else orbits. It's the McDonald's restaurant, no different than any McDonald's restaurant circa 1971, except something is off. It's not big enough, maybe, but it also feels empty. Emptier than you ever thought possible. A deep, black void, nothingness contained in brown brick and mortar, capped with a red and yellow Manford roof. Nothing comes into and nothing goes out of this McDonald's. It just sits, its bottomless black windows like sinister eyes that take everything in, watching always. Ronald and his friends, we'll get to them in a bit. They eat there, but not in there. They sit at a picnic table in front of the building and eat food that Ronald produces, seemingly out of thin air. The land around the restaurant has a decidedly prehistoric feel, though everything you see, the landscape, is clearly a facade of astroturf and foam rubber. What is it hiding? There are mountains in the distance, large palms and ferns in the middle ground, green grass below your feet. The most notable aspect, though, the thing you notice right away, is the atmosphere. It is chokingly thick, hot and greasy, infused with the smell of rot cut with sweetness. The sky is a hazy swirl of red and rust, clearly the result of some cataclysmic natural disaster, perhaps the eruption of one of the many thick-shake volcanoes that dot the terrain and rain cold, sticky death upon the land and its inhabitants each and every day. As a result, everything is sticky to the touch. Unless it's greasy to the touch, like the French fry bushes or the hamburger heads in the hamburger patch, ghastly anamorphic plant-meat hybrids with googly eyes that look pleadingly at you, begging you to devour them and end their unceasing misery, often squealing, sickeningly lilting siren songs. By this point, you're covered in a thick film of something, and the urge to wash it off is overwhelming. You look about in panic. What luck? A lake. You go towards it and haven't gone 20 feet before you run face first into an invisible wall of stink, hot and fishy, that causes you to retch. This is the Filet-O-Fish Lake, the most horrifically monikered body of water in recorded history. And then, in the distance, you hear the clomp slap of gigantic feet, inhuman chuckles, and a voice saying, "Is that Robble Robble?" Okay, open your eyes. This hellish, meat-infused mockery of Willy Wonka's candy plantation was developed in 1971 by Needham, Harper, and Steers at the behest of Ray Kroc and his shadow partners, the McDonald Brothers. Shadow, despite being the restaurant's name, because as far as the public knew, Kroc had more or less stolen the business out from under them. In fact, this was all a ruse to put folks off the Illuminati trail. Classic Illuminati. Kroc was, of course, Illuminati as well, but as he didn't bear the Christian name of an ancient family in the order, he became the face of the company. Until Ronald McDonald became the face of the company. The McDonald brothers, Richard and Maurice, had begun the restaurant as a front for a ritualistic sex murder dungeon in 1940. The smell of fast food was a perfect cover for the orgiastic funk emitting from the basement, and the hustle and bustle of restaurant work masked the screams of pleasure and pain and pleasure pain. The hope was that all of the ritualistic coitus and slaughter would summon the Dark One and his minions, and they would bring about a reckoning that would result in a new world order. Instead, their hamburgers became very popular. That wasn't all bad. The Illuminati loves to hoard money, and the McDonald brothers soon began making a lot of it. They used some of it to open more restaurant dungeons all over the West Coast. They used some of it to buy whips, candles, goats, incense, hooded robes, masks, grimoires, orphans, daggers, sex swings, Iron Maidens, racks, pendulums, serpents, poisons, and snacks. Even Illuminati loves snacks. During one of their Magic with a K orgies at the original San Bernardino location, the brothers met Ray Kroc. The three of them, bemasked and berobed, were ritualistic hacking a young victim to pieces as a sacrifice to Beelzebub after they'd had their way with him for hours on end when Croc asked the brothers if they'd ever considered franchising. They hadn't, but Croc convinced them that it would be the most effective way to spread Illuminati influence throughout the world, and the rest is history. Soon the brothers went underground, so to speak, to spend more time in their sex murder dungeons and plot the proliferation of the One World agenda. In 1971, Ray Kroc had another brilliant idea. McDonald's would begin to target children, the dumbest and most long-living of all types of people. Ronald McDonald already existed, kind of. He'd been McDonald's spokesperson since his invention by noted weather doofus Willard Scott in 1963, but this is not the Ronald we know today. The character was merely an extension of Scott's work as Bozo the Clown, a simple, benign clown, if such a thing can be said to exist. He wore a hat made of a fast food tray and had a cup for a nose. Was he horrifying to look at? Sure, all clowns are, especially plump, hastily thrown together garbage clowns. Scott was soon dumped for being too portly and his memory mostly scrubbed from the popular consciousness. He was replaced by a version closer to the Ronald McDonald we know today, visually anyway, but was mostly just a happy picture to use in print ads, not a character. What happened next would change that. First, as per the chain of command, Kroc consulted with Satan via human sacrifice at the Great Masonic Altar. Satan referred to Zorvath, Earth diplomat of the Lizard People, also known as Henry Kissinger, who approved the plan and referred Kroc to the Illuminati's advertising agency of choice, Needham, Harper & Steers, who had handled such Illuminati business as the Heinz, Fruit of the Loom, and Slinky accounts. They were masters of symbolism and subliminal messaging, not to mention conjoined triplets with the gift of second sight. Needham, Harper, and Steers, also known as the Van Twin Brothers, heirs to an Illuminati bloodline in their own rights, had a very peculiar method of constructing advertising campaigns. First, they would smoke a rare, powerful opium known as the Unknowable. Then they would sacrifice a silverback gorilla on an altar of baby skulls. Then they would touch hands and the ad campaign would emerge fully formed, materialized via a blood pen that Needham Van Dwin, the center brother, held between his first and second toes. Finally, they would present, psychically, the sketches and notes to Brink, a powerful gray who would produce the finished product with his mind. No actors, no crew necessary. And that's it. That's how McDonaldland came to be, without much tangible thought as we know it. The Illuminati agenda has been manifesting beyond the realm of knowable human means since the 1764 truce between the Greys and the Reptilians. Its human components have very little control and are really only culpable through their initial consent. What a world. Anyway, though the means of producing propaganda like McDonaldland are what we would call paranormal, the symbolism within them, the markers by which they promote their agenda, are very human. They have to be. Those they wish to control are human. So let's explore some of that symbolism. We'll begin at the center of McDonaldland, the mad, unknowable chasm from which all came, the previously mentioned restaurant. The first thing one notices when approaching the restaurant are the infamous golden arches. The arches serve a dual symbolic purpose, even aside from those previously noted. Turn the left arch 90 degrees counterclockwise, and you get the unmistakable image of the Ouroboros, the snake eating its own tail that the Illuminati used to symbolize the never-ending nature of their dastardly organization. Push that bottom arch up a few inches, and there it is. The infamous square and compass of the Freemasons. The next thing you'll notice is the roof, what's known as a Manford roof, basically a pyramid with the top lopped off. Sound familiar? It should. It's also on the back of the dollar bill, the self-same currency that you use to purchase food at, you guessed it, McDonald's. Furthermore, the restaurant is clearly a stand-in for the all-seeing eye that is at the center of Illuminati symbolism. Just look at those windows. The restaurant is watching you. It is, for lack of a better word, God. A God. Satan, really, who is the God of the Illuminati. Of course, Satan is just the name given to it by humans. Its true form and nature are beyond our comprehension, but it pulls the strings that move the world. A cruel inversion of the Alpha and the Omega. It is the evil from which all evil was born, the evil in which all good disappears. It is the pulsing heart of darkness. I won't speculate further on the interior of the restaurant. Like I said, it's unknowable. Some believe that Ronald McDonald was once just a regular man, and a mere glimpse through a window of the restaurant turned him into the wan, perma-grinning freak he is today. I don't want to risk that, certainly. Ronald McDonald, the restaurant's dark emissary to the outside world, was not, in fact, transformed by the restaurant, but emerged from it, as did all of McDonaldland. His clown makeup is a mockery of the Christian concept of the Christ. He is part man, part God. Look at his magical powers. They are shocking, but limited. He can materialize the golden arches, for instance. He can animate the inanimate. He can summon props and manifest parties. He can dance at turbo speed. He can fly, sometimes. He represents the Illuminati itself. Their reach is staggering, but to their constant frustration, far from omnipotent. They are not gods, and therefore must continue to rely upon those that are. We previously discussed the blank slate nature of Ronald McDonald. This is his most insidious power. Ronald is whatever you want or need Ronald to be. A magician, friend, rock star, food source, protector, a shoulder to cry on or a font of fun. He can be a symbol of all that is good for the believers or a symbol of all that is evil for the naysayers. Ronald McDonald is fine with that. His place as a poison-mongering corporate shill among the tree-crazy, kale-munching, poor-people-protecting, absolutely correct on most things, hippy-dippy liberal set is no accident. Divide and conquer, as they say. You have to tear it all down to rebuild, to construct the new world order. Ronald McDonald is a Pied Piper, merrily leading us all unto our great destiny, which, for most, will involve not a little bit of hellfire and some hard whiffs of sulfur. Speaking of us, let us discuss Grimace. Grimace is us, our representation inside of the McDonald Landiverse, anyway. Grimace began life as the evil Grimace, a purple worsted felt blob with four arms and a crippling triple-thick chocolate shake addiction. Eventually, he was tamed by Ronald McDonald via appeals to his vanity while cleverly disguised as a Hollywood director and a mailman, which I don't think I have to point out to you is a federal employee. The Hollywood director ruse slyly portends the dumbing down of our society through reality television. Ultimately, two of the evil Grimace's arms are severed, and he becomes the lovable, brainless sycophant that we know and love today. Us, in other words. The proletariat. Don't believe me? Refer, if you will, to the 1993 Where's Grimace's Voice advertising campaign, in which Grimace's voice left his body and inhabited the bodies of a series of, quote, regular people. Case closed. One more thing about Grimace. Over the years, many have wondered what exactly he is supposed to be. The folks at McDonald's have proffered two explanations. That he is, quote, the essence of a milkshake, which is preposterous mumbo-jumbo, of course, or that he is, quote, a taste bud, reasonable but false. Grimace, whose name is a description of the face mankind will make once their enslavement under Illuminati rule becomes apparent, is a depiction of what the Greys see when they look at us. Blubbering, featureless blobs descended from Irish trash, as evidenced by Grimace's uncle, promoter of the Shamrock Shake, Uncle O'Grimacy. On to Mayor McCheese and Officer Big Mac, McDonaldland's two-headed straw boss. These two bumbling, do-nothing oafs represent our two-party system. They are a front, a joke. Do they know this? Do they imagine that they have real power? Wait, what's that on Officer Big Mac's chest? Is it a badge or a pentagram? The Hamburglar. There is no PC way to say this. The Hamburglar represents the Jewish cabal, the group the Illuminati wants you to believe ruled the world. Just look at him. It got better in the 80s, but the Hamburglar began his life as a crude Semitic caricature. Big crooked nose? Check. Small dark rat eyes? Check. Long gray scraggly hair? Check. Nervous mouncy countenance? Check. The man is a greedy thief for, you'll excuse the expression, Christ's sake. He may as well have been dreamed up by Goebbels. The Illuminati want you to believe he is a villain. He is a MacGuffin. A McGuffin. Here's a fun fact. In the original McDonaldland commercials, the Hamburglar was identified as the Lone Jogger. A sly wink at the Kennedy assassination? Yes, definitely. Who does that leave? Yes, the Professor and Captain Crook. The Professor represents the academic side of the Illuminati and may refer back to the alchemists. Captain Crook, your guess is as good as mine. I'll tell you this, though. His sword looks an awful lot like an inverted cross. Fry guys. Fry guys are thinly disguised owls, much like the owl hidden on the back of the $1 bill. They're always watching. There is one other character in McDonaldland. Perceptive listeners are most likely shouting his name at their phone or whatever. We'll get to him in the startling conclusion of this episode after another short commercial break. Don't go turning that dial.
Hello, it's me again, your old pal Burlap Bundy, pleading with you to get the Burlap Bundy Solid Gold Survivalist Storage Chest for the sake of you and yours. I feel like maybe the brevity of the piece of speculative fiction I read earlier didn't exactly convey just how good this stuff I wrote really is. So here's another taste. Really listen this time. I mean, really listen. Sweat dripped down Burl's rippling back, veering off course with each of his animalistic screams. You goddamn feathered queers! Is that all you got? The birds let loose with their lusty, lilting caws and slid deeper inside of him, one after another, clawing with their taloned fingers at his tender, unblemished, sun-darkened but still very much white skin. Run, Sarah Palin, Burl yelled between grunts. Grab Ann Coulter and get out of here while there's still time. Don't look back. I'll be fine. Godspeed. Then the gay birdmen began to let loose with torrent after torrent of AIDS-infected bird jizz that splattered against his face, slowly dripping into his mouth, hot and salty, and against his flexing back and firm butt. He felt a hot load explode inside of him and nearly shrieked. See? See how good that is? If you don't order this gastern box after that, I just don't know what to tell you, and that's a fact. Again, call 1-800-GOLD-BOX now and get a free space pen. Burlap Bundy's Solid Gold Survivalist Storage Chest. It's a necessity, and that's a fact.
It's Valentine's Day, 2016, and my wife and I are back at the Sweetheart Ball. It's going great as these things can go. She looks beautiful. I look beautiful. We've made a promising bid on a signed headshot of Dr. Drew that is up for auction for some reason. I now realize that the reason is that Dr. Drew is the official doctor of the Illuminati. The food is good, not the typical giant bowl of pasta that you're served when you select the vegetarian option. The reception is basically the same as last year, minus, sadly, a song by Ronald McDonald. Ronald is there, of course, but he seems a bit forlorn. He's going through his whole shtick, posing for pictures, glad-handing, making everyone generally uncomfortable, but it comes off as half-hearted, and his face is even more craggy than it was last year. Like, maybe he started drinking again after a long bout of sobriety. At one point, I notice him sitting on a folding chair in a darkened back corner of the ballroom, staring down at his gloved hands. His absence, if only emotional, fails to put a damper on the evening. In fact, we are getting on quite nicely with a peculiar older couple that is seated at our table. They are Fraser Wilfinger and his wife, Jelida Jo Barcia Wilfinger, a handsome pair, done up to the nines in black tie standards with expensive-looking accoutrements. Brazier is regaling us with a clearly well-worn, but no less astounding story about tasing George W. Bush mid-swing on the 8th tee box of Fishers Island Golf Club during a Skull and Bones alumni golf tournament in 2005. Jelida, who insists we call her Joe, is rolling her still very youthful, heavily painted, deep green eyes as if to say, "Stop boring these kids with your incredible tale of brutally assaulting a sitting president, one of the worst of all time, no less, during a gathering of one of the most secretive of societies." I couldn't be more thrilled, and Frazier is loving the attention. I ask him what he does or did or whatever. He says he was an advisor, to whom or of what he will not say, and that he's currently retired, is spending his retirement in North Dakota because, quote, "the passing of the seasons is a terrific demarcation of the passing of my ever less golden years." I tell him I like the cut of his jib. He says something about labor laws, and I say, "Fuck the proletariat, am I right?" And we all laugh, and he winks at me and claps me on the back and says, "You're all right, son, let me buy you a drink." I say that I no longer drink, and he says that's wonderful. He should probably quit himself. Joe's been at him to do just that for years, but you know how it goes. I say, "Boy, do I ever." He asks if I enjoy a fine cigar. I say that I usually enjoy a shitty cigar, but a fine one might be a nice change of pace. And we excuse ourselves to go outside, and he grabs the vice president of McDonald's, David Fairhurst, on our way out. He's a stocky fellow with good hair, an open collar, and chinchilla eyes. I don't like him. He doesn't say much, just puffs away on his cigar. Mostly, Frazier and I just break each other's balls about this and that. As our cigars are receding just below the halfway point, I say that I better get back inside. Kelly will be waiting for me. Frazier agrees, but as we're leaving, he says, "Hey, David, maybe we should invite Mr. Messerschmidt here to the after party."
"Do you think that would be wise?" Fairhurst asks.
Frazier looks at me probingly.
"Yeah, I think it would," he says, still staring.
"If you say so,"
replies Fairhurst.
"What would you say to attending an exclusive after party of sorts? It should be very interesting, and there might be some opportunities in it for you if you play your cards right."
My God, this is what I've been waiting for my entire life. Access. Fucking access. I'll run it by Kelly, see what she thinks, but if I have my way, we are in.
"You make sure that you do. Have your way. And meet us in the basement of this place at 11 p.m. I'll put you and your wife on the list."
I do have my way, though it takes some doing. Kelly agrees to let me stay while she goes home to relieve the babysitter. I bide our time until just before 11, a terrible Valentine's date. I don't take home the signed headshot of Dr. Drew. I'm too busy biding to keep up with the bidding. I apologize for the previous sentence. When the time comes, I kiss Kelly goodbye and attempt to make my way to the basement via the elevator. There is not a basement button, so I go to the lobby and look around. I still can't find it, so I ask the woman at the reception desk, a surprisingly aged, one-eyed woman. You usually find a young, two-eyed person at these positions. She nervously looks up at me from her hunch.
"There is no basement."
She is obviously lying. There's a look in her good eye. Her glass eye reveals nothing but a reflection of my own perplexed face. "Frazier Wilfinger invited me," I say. "He said there would be a get-together in the basement at about this time."
"I'll have to make a phone call. Your name, please."
"Messerschmidt," I say. "Reed Messerschmidt." She hurriedly waddles into a back room from which I can hear some indistinct whispering. She comes back, still very nervous.
"Someone will be with you momentarily."
Just then, from directly behind me, a deep, dull baritone.
"Follow me, Mr. Messerschmidt."
I spin around to face the voice. Nothing. I lower my gaze and let out an audible gasp. The man behind me is tiny, maybe 3 feet tall, a miniature version of a classic butler in bow tie and tails, stony-faced, regal. He spins on his heels and begins walking towards a nondescript door to the left of the continental breakfast counter. I'd assumed it was some kind of kitchen. It is, I discover, as he opens the door after turning what I now notice is an unusually low doorknob, a large storage closet filled with single-serving jellies, honeys, and peanut butters, white bread, mini boxes of cereal, and fruit boxes. There's another door in the back, one that was obviously covered up by fruit boxes, but they have been moved off to the side, presumably for tonight's festivities. There's a bejeweled owl knocker on the door, about 2 feet off of the floor. The wee butler uses it to knock 3 times, and the door slowly swings inwards. Smoke billows into the closet, cigar smoke by the smell of it. There's a dim light, a stairway, the sound of dozens of conversations, laughing. The wee butler nods at me and extends an arm down the stairs.
Go on, sir, if you please.
This is getting very weird, but I keep my head. I have to act like I belong. Fucking access. My heart is beating faster than the Micro Machine Man running lines for Aaron Sorkin. I begin to descend the stairs, rickety and wooden. When my foot hits the 4th step, the room goes silent. I still can't see what's down there. I look back at the wee butler, now at eye level. He nods with his index finger on his lips. I proceed silently, and he closes the door behind me. Just then, the lights below go out. I consider making a break for it. Access. I keep going, carefully. The light is replaced with softer light, candlelight. 4 stairs later, a bizarre scene opens up before me. There are about 50 people in the room, all facing front. I recognize some of the clothes from earlier in the night, but they are all wearing masks, though I can't see what the masks depict from the back, only the strap holding them on their heads. Candles line the wall, illuminating elaborate Gothic murals of Illuminati symbols intermixed with grotesque depictions of violent and sexual acts taking place in McDonaldland. Ronald, devouring fry guys, his red smile indistinguishable from his blood-soaked face, a crazed look in his eyes, the rest of the guys looking on in helpless agony. Captain Crook performing harakiri with his sword, his entrails spilled out onto the bright green grass, his face twisted in agony, peering up at the sky. Mayor McCheese sodomizing an ecstatic Hamburglar, more Semitic than ever, atop the decomposing corpse of Officer Big Mac. The evil Grimace chewing off his extra limbs, becoming just Grimace, his eyes bloodshot and his teeth bared. My eyes follow this bizarre scene, catch for just a moment a vague but somehow recognizable figure in the corner, move on to the stage at the front of the room, the one everyone else is facing. Ronald McDonald is standing on the stage, his head bowed as though in prayer. Behind him there is a gigantic eye, the all-seeing eye, outlined in gold, its iris and pupil encrusted with jewels. I take another step, and the stair creaks under me. Ronald looks up, enraged but calm, and the rest turn towards me, slightly panicked. They're all wearing the masks of various McDonaldland characters, and they're all holding candles. It would be funny if it wasn't so horrifying. I'm about to nervously apologize when I see a sharp-dressed Hamburglar hurrying through the crowd in my direction. He hands me a Grimace mask and whispers, "You're late." "It's Frasier. Put this on and stand in the back. I've got to get back to my spot." He leaves me, gets back to his spot, and nods at Ronald, who nods at the rest of the congregation. They do look like a congregation. I put on the mask and stand next to a Mayor McCheese in the back. She's wearing a red dress. Ronald rebows his head and begins to speak, the candlelight throwing dancing shadows on the deep lines of his painted face.
"Let us now pray to our Dark Lord. Oh, Dark Lord, we beseech thee. These are troubled times, and the people," he spits out the word like an hour-old wad of big league chew, "the people have grown weary of our food, health-conscious, and our firm, choking grip is threatening to slip, even at this very moment. Please accept our sacrifice that the masses may hunger for hamburgers once more. Prepare the sacrifice!"
Everyone begins to chant, slowly and quietly at first, but gaining momentum.
"Grimace,
Grimace, 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 Grimace. This is incredible, I'm thinking, when suddenly the crowd parts before me and two unseen individuals grab my arms in a muscular grip. What the? Ronald raises a tube to his lips and blows hard. A dart emerges, shooting through the crowd, sticks into my neck with a thump and a quick sting. And then I feel nothing. I go limp. I've been tranquilized. But it turns out I can still scream, which I do as three men peer before me with a full Grimace costume. With the help of the two men holding my arms, they fit the costume over my head. Everything goes dark for a moment, and then there's some light. The eye screen and the costume's dumb, grinning mouth. I'm raised into the air and passed as though crowd surfing up to the dais, screaming all the way. Out of the corner of my eye, I see the shadowy figure in the corner move, and then I am placed on a table, staring up through the Grimace's mouth. And then, above me, the Dark Lord himself appears, the eyes in his crescent moon-shaped head obscured by Ray-Bans. My God, I think, it's Mac Tonight, the moon-headed, Sinatra-esque crooner that was briefly introduced into McDonald's marketing campaign to sell cheeseburgers to adults in the late 1980s. Of course it's Mac Tonight. I've been so blind. It's been Mac Tonight all along. And then the sneering moon man is raising a large, ornate knife over his head, and the congregation is practically screaming now, Grimace! 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 And I am oddly calm, resigned to my fate, heroic inside this purple taste bud-shaped costume, and he brings the knife down, and it enters me painlessly, and I die, and now I'm dead.
The end. Grimace, 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 Grimace.